Okay, you guys, no matter if you're training for something big or you're just trying to get lean and stay healthy, your body requires a lot of protein. In fact, around 1 gram per pound of body weight. Now, cooking whole foods is best, but I'm going to be honest, sometimes I need help hitting my protein count with clean, on-the-go nutrition that works for both myself and my family. But that is a lot harder than it sounds. I've been searching for months to find a super clean, affordable protein powder that actually tastes good, has a full amino acid profile, and doesn't upset my stomach. Finally, I found Equip Foods Prime Protein. And seriously, you guys, I am hooked. Prime Protein has over 2,000 five-star reviews because there's no junk, fillers, or additives ever. Equip's unflavored grass-fed beef isolate protein powder has only one ingredient. All of their flavors taste amazing. Vanilla happens to be my favorite. They mix well. They can be added to countless low-carb and keto recipes. You can make a quick shake with just one scoop and get a 21-gram protein instantly. You guys, that's like eating 4 ounces of steak. Every single batch of Prime Protein is certified non-GMO and is free of glyphosate and heavy metals. If you need a delicious, easy-to-use, easy-to-digest, clean protein powder, seriously, you guys need to check out Equip. You can save 15% off with my code DRFIT, D-R-F-I-T, at equipfoods.com. And by the way, every single bag comes with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't love it, send it back for a full refund. No questions asked. To the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman. Hello, everybody. Dr. Jamie Seaman, and welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. It's fantastic to have you here today. We have a guest back on the podcast for the second time. Dr. Sean Baker and I recorded a long time ago, so you guys go check out that previous episode with Sean if you didn't catch it. Well, to the carnivore community, I don't think he needs any introduction, but Dr. Baker, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks for having me here. Appreciate it. It's good talking to you again.
Okay, so for the people who are, for the vegans who are listening, can you tell them? No, they probably know who you are too. Okay, for the regular people listening, can you tell people who you are?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, I am a physician. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. That was my practice for many, many years. I now am a founder, CMO of a company called Rivero, which is a digital health company. We're licensed in all 50 states to provide basically, you know, root cause medical care to try to get people off medications. I am a proponent of, meat-based diets, carnivore. I wrote a book called The Carnivore Diet, and I think I use that as a therapeutic protocol for helping people to either recover from food addiction or, you know, mitigate or potentially reverse diseases. I'm an athlete. I've been an athlete my whole life. I'm an advocate of exercise and strength training and sprinting. And I tend to be a little, I guess, mischievous a bit in pushing back at some of the, what I find nonsense about, the world wanting us to become sort of plant-based, I don't know, crazy people.
Yeah, no, I'm hearing it left and right in my clinic room. Patients come in and saying, my doctor told me to eat a plant-based diet. You were recently on Joe Rogan. I want to hear about that experience.
Yeah. So it was interesting because I was on initially about 6 years ago, and this is when I kind of, the world was exposed to my crazy, crazy dietary preference of eating a bunch of meat. And Joe looked at me at that time like I had a third eyeball, you know. And this time, very, very different because Joe has experienced it. He's seen the literally thousands upon thousands of people. And so he was very much actually like promoting the fact that what we're doing works. And he was saying that, you know, I've never met anybody that has gone on this diet that has not had a positive result. So it was a very different vibe. So he's very much on board with, meat as a health food. And, you know, obviously he's a hunter and he's just always been very, very nice to me, very obviously generous guy with his time. He's obviously a busy person. It's kind of funny. The reason I came back on, and he mentioned bringing me on, several times before, but I had a little recent neck injury because I was doing jujitsu and I got stuffed and, my neck got, kind of like all of my body weight plus another 200 pound guy landed on my head. My neck got rolled. So I ended up with a disc herniation. I had a lot of, ridiculous pain down my arm and had been rehabbing that. And generally it's almost pretty much all gone, but he said, "Hey, why don't you come out to Austin and I will, set you up with some stem cells and we'll do a podcast." I said, "Well, that sounds good to me. I'm skeptical about stem cells, to be honest." But anyway, so that's how it evolved. And I think he's sort of, like many people, has seen what's going on as far as what we're talking about, people being asked to, and so far nicely, but you just wonder if we're not going to be asked and we're going to be told and forced to, cut back on our meat consumption, which I think would be a dramatic and drastic problem with lots of unintended consequences.
So he brought you back 6 years later to make sure you were still alive from eating this all meat diet.
He actually mentioned it. He goes, "Good to see you're still alive." And I said, "Well, yeah, okay. I'm not dead yet. Still doing okay."
Can you, dive into what you said a little bit about this? I think you're alluding to the fact that there is a political agenda involving food and nutrition, and especially meat. Why is meat so controversial? Why is it so political?
Well, I think it ultimately comes down to money. Ultimately, like most things do. If you look at, we just saw the United Nations announce to the world that, hey, the United States needs to cut back on meat consumption. And then if you look at who's funding the United Nations, it's processed food companies like Coca-Cola, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, our major donors to the UN. Bill Gates has came out flat and said we need to eat, synthetic meat or fake meat. And he's heavily invested in that. We know that unequivocally, when people give up animal products, they consume more processed food. That is just what happens. There was actually a recent study on that showing that the people that consume the most processed foods are the people that tend to be the most plant-based, i.e. vegans. And the other thing is processed foods are incredibly, ultra processed foods particularly, are incredibly profitable, much more profitable than beef. And so when you have global asset management companies like Vanguard, BlackRock, Stateside Group, Capital Assets Group, which control $20 trillion worth of capital worldwide, and they sit on the boards of these processed food companies, or they control significant shares of processed food companies, they control significant shares of pharmaceutical industries, it's not hard to see where that is just designed to make as much profit as possible. If you look at, for instance, the United States, we had 132 million head of cattle in 1975. We only have 90 million right now. So we've dramatically, the number of cattle in the United States has gone down since the 70s. The average American back then was consuming around 95-ish pounds of beef per year. That's down to about 53 pounds. So we've dramatically dropped our consumption of red meat, or particularly beef, over the last 50 years. And although you can't directly use correlation as causation, but certainly when you're trying to make the argument that beef is making us sick, we're eating much less of it, and we're sicker, more so now than we were before. So that those things don't seem to hold up. The same thing with atmospheric methane, for instance. Again, the world cattle population is also down. So we have less cows in the world today than we had before, and yet global methane numbers have gone up. So it's not coming from the cattle per se. Yes, they do. They do emit some cattle through their through enteric fermentation. However, in the United States, that represents about 2% of our greenhouse gases, whereas, we can look at, fossil fuel, energy, transportation, industry sectors creating 90%. So that 2% in the United States, you compare that to the healthcare sector, which both you and I work in. The healthcare sector puts out anywhere between 4 and 10% of our greenhouse gases. And when you have more sick people, guess what? You're going to have more emissions, right? And so what I'm seeing is people consuming meat actually becoming less dependent upon the healthcare system. So they're actually improving that. In addition, rather than getting rid of cattle, there's many ways to mitigate the amount of methane they produce anyway, either through food additives, which guys like Frank Mitlaner at UC Davis are doing and proving quite nicely that occurs. And also folks that are doing, quote unquote, regenerative agriculture, where they're completely offsetting carbon, and actually they're a carbon sink. And so they can reduce that. So it is completely unnecessary for us to decrease our meat consumption or reduce the number of cattle. However, is financially lucrative to convince us to do so. And I think that's really what's going on there.
Yeah, it's really scary, the amount of politics in medicine and pharma. So you say that people who eat less meat eat more processed foods. So what happens when these people cut processed foods and start eating more meat in their diet? Let's just say it's even just a whole food diet with more red meat, or all the way to a carnivore diet. Why are they getting healthier? Why are they seeing benefits?
Well, I think one, you're increasing the amount of high quality bioavailable protein. We know that, you know, animal protein is a complete protein. It's more easily accessible. And then two, I think these ultra processed foods, you know, generally are problematic, and they lead to probably a lot of gut problems, a lot of inflammatory issues for many people. In many cases, they're just not high quality nutrition. I mean, it's very low calorie. You know, one of the things, you know, let me just expand back upon this. You know, one of the issues that people talk about is, you know, greenhouse gases per calorie or greenhouse gas per volume of food. And they'll always say, well, beef has a higher emission potential, which is true. But when you actually look at things that actually probably matter more than calories, it's like actual nutrition, like what kind of nutrients are in beef, you know, essential amino acids, you know, critical nutrients. And you run that calculus, then it looks much more even. And in fact, if you wanted to eat like the most or one of the most calorie efficient foods as per amount of greenhouse gases emitted, it would be sugar. Sugar is very easy to produce. It takes very little resources. It emits very little greenhouse gases, but it's not good for us. So, and this is what we're seeing, this push for ultra processed food. But yeah, I, again, speculating what I see, I deal with literally tens of thousands of people now that have done this carnivore diet. And I see routinely a lot of improvements in gut health. And I think a lot of the disease starts in our gut. I mean, you know, it makes sense. You know, if there's an environmental impact on our health, you know, one of the biggest environments that we're exposed to, as you know, our GI tract is external to our body. So it's actually outside of our body when we bring that in there. And so that's something that we're exposed to. And the wrong food is a problem. It really is. And I don't think any of us, I mean, we can debate about how much fiber we ate 50,000 years ago and what was available and, you know, cave paintings and the lack of broccoli on cave paintings and things like that. But at the end of the day, what we know clearly, what was not available was all this ultra processed food, which we consume today at the rate of nearly 70% of our diet is now ultra processed food. And the really sad thing is, the USDA is sort of priming us to continue to do so. And once, and you know, they just, I don't know if you saw the study I talked about on Rogan, you know, USDA came out with a NOVA study, 91% ultra processed food diet can be quote unquote healthy is what they're trying to say. And so they're trying to, because a lot of us have pushed back and said, we just need to stop eating this garbage and make, you know, cook at home, make home cooked food, you know, use single ingredients. Clearly that's a better approach, but the ultra processed food industry, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Nestle, you know, all these huge, huge global corporations with trillions of dollars don't want that message. They want you to continue. They want you to continue on the ultra processed food tract. And, it is literally killing people. It is literally causing people to have horrible, horrible diseases. And the one, you know, and I, as I mentioned, as you probably know, when you eat, you know, particularly red meat, particularly beef, it's satiating and satisfying to the point that you don't tend to want those other things in many cases. And I deal with a lot of people with food addiction. And, you know, I had a gal the other day, she was literally 800 pounds, which is just shocking. And she, you know, she had been just unable to, she had a gastric band surgery. She had had every vegan diet, juicing diet, you know, Weight Watchers, all these things. And it wasn't until she went fully carnivore that she was able to kick that addiction to, you know, sweetened processed foods, you know, cakes and ice creams and chocolates and things like that. And she said she finally found the off switch. And so they don't want you to find the off switch. They like the switch on, you know, because it's very profitable for them. So that is, you know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff we could talk about with the physiology that I think is going on, or we know to some degree it is. And there's a lot of things that, you know, as you know, the human body is incredibly complex, and we can always find several mechanisms that support our theory. But at the end of the day, when you cut out animal products out of your diet, you just eat more ultra processed food. That's what the reality is. It's not that everybody's going to start eating you know, beans and quinoa. They're just going to start eating, you know, ultra processed energy because they're hungry.
Well, and the food manufacturers are smart. So they're making stuff look like it's organic and healthy, and they use, you know, special words and pack on the packaging and labels and things like that. Because I will have a patient who comes in and says, yeah, I'm really eating a pretty good diet. And then when I do a 24-hour dietary recall and I say, okay, tell me what you ate yesterday. What's a typical day like for you? And they start naming things off. I mean, half of it might come from the health food section, but it's still ultra processed food. I mean, it's just like putting lipstick on a pig.
Yeah, it's you know, it's like, you know, obviously the front label is extremely misleading. Natural, organic, you know, all these things, these terms that are you know, abused. They're not really regulated. You flip it over and you look at the ingredients, you're like, wait a minute, that's supposed to be good for me? And honestly, I think in many cases, if you're reading labels reading the ingredients label, you probably just put it down and pick something that doesn't have an ingredients label on it. And that would be your, you know, your meats and your fruits and vegetables and things of that nature, which you don't need to read a label. You know what it is, basically. And
it is,
because we're seeing a lot of this greenwashing. And every time I see, like, I walk down the aisle and I'll see this thing made with the power of plants or plant-based, blah, blah, blah. And all that means to me is cheap and profitable ingredients, because that's what it is. It's cheaper. It's more profitable for them. And so it's not good for you.
Yeah. I mean, when you see something like a box of cereal, it's like 10 for $10. Like, I mean, they're making a profit at 10 for $10. Like, what's in there? It's just a bunch of garbage. Okay. So, another carnivore doctor on social media, Dr. Paul Saladino, you guys have differing views on how you live your life, I guess. He has really kind of made a divergence into eating more fruit and honey and these types of things. And I've seen it create this, you know, little squalls in the carnivore community. What are do people really need to be all meat, zero carb? Or is it really just about eating whole foods and getting enough meat?
Well, I think it depends on the person. I mean, some people do. I mean, at least for a period of time, for sure. I mean, I think there's people that, because I see people that are on this, you know, sort of very clean whole food diet with just meat and like a few fruits and vegetables. And they do improve when you remove those. And it may be, you know, an autoimmune condition. Maybe their gut isn't healed enough. And many people, after they spend 6 months, a year doing that, they're able to reintroduce it. Some people find, particularly I think people that struggle with food addiction, that when they start reintroducing fruit and other, you know, what you think would otherwise seemingly be healthy foods, it just drives that addiction back and they get back on this sort of sugary roller coaster. So for some people, it's a problem. I don't think anybody has to have fruits and honey and all that stuff in their diet to be successful. I think some people tolerate it better than others. And if they do, it can be beneficial, you know, particularly like talk about athletes, because I'm a huge proponent of exercise. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things you can actually do to, you know, impact your health long term. And for some of those people that are otherwise pretty healthy, I mean, I think, you know, a little bit of carbohydrate in forms like that can be beneficial. But I do push back when people say the only way you can be healthy is to include a lot of carbohydrates in your diet, because I clearly disagree with that, because I've seen, and the arguments for that, you know, oh, it's going to drive up cortisol and some of these other things really don't hold up when you look at it, particularly over in a chronic situation. And so, I'm more of a person that says there's a lot of ways to get healthy. And I, I'm obviously an advocate for a relatively strict carnivore diet, and I'm not religious about it. I mean, I will eat 98% of my calories that come from meat, but every once in a while I'll have something off the plan it's not a religion to me. But
what would you have? What's off plan?
Well, I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm not eating broccoli because I hate the stuff. You know, I'm not, like my son's birthday was last week and Thanksgiving, so I had a piece of pumpkin pie, you know. So, you know, it's clearly not health food, but it literally represents less than probably 0.01% of my diet. So it's not, you know, it's like, I don't really, you know, get too concerned about that. But, the biggest thing I just push back again is, you know, the people saying that you're going to get sick if you don't include carbohydrates in your diet. And there may be some people for which that is true, but it's clearly not true for at least a segment of the population that I deal with on a regular basis.
Yeah. I was talking to John Jaquish on my podcast a couple of months ago, and I asked him the question, if he thought there was a difference between men and women, and I'm interested to hear your answer too. I tend to do better with a small amount of carbohydrates. I just feel better. I just feel like I function better. And he was saying that his wife is kind of the same way. She actually craves a little more egg and cheese and things that actually naturally have some more carbs in it than just red meat. But I'm interested to hear, you know, in your work with clients and patients in Ribeiro, do you think there's a difference between men and women when it comes to this diet?
Well, I was going to say, yeah, there's clearly a difference. You're an obstetrician, so you know there's a difference between men and women. But yeah, I do think there is.
We're complex, okay?
Yeah, no, I got it. Yeah, I remember somebody joking medicals. You could wipe out a whole year of medical school if you didn't have to do obstetrics because it's just so, it's add so much complexity to the problem. But you know, my spouse the same way. She's mostly carnivore, but she still consumes a little bit of fruit and things like that. And I think, you know, as you know, women have a little bit more body fat than men. That's just one of the inherent differences. I think women have different sort of energy demands. Obviously, there's a cyclical nature to, you know, women when they're in their sort of, you know, reproductive, you know, ages. I think in my experience, just in carnivore alone, many women do better with a little bit higher, more energy in their diet, maybe a little bit more fat relative to what a man might be able to do. It might be because of more effective brain power and, you know, just kidding on that. But I do see that where some women will need that. I've seen like women, particularly women go through pregnancy, and I've seen several women do a carnivore pregnancy. The first trimester in particular, they say they just need, you know, whatever, they need some more carbs or something else besides meat. I think that that is one of the things that, you know, I routinely see. And then you have, you know, obviously the whole issue with perimenopausal issues where it's there's a lot of differences that come in there. It's very frustrating for a lot of women because they don't tend to lose weight as easily as men do, particularly in that age category, for, you know, a host of reasons, which you probably are better acquainted than even I am. But yeah, I think there are some differences.
Yeah, I think we're still trying to figure it out. What about organ meats? Do you think people need to be eating the whole animal, nose to tail?
No, I don't. I think that, interesting, you know, if you go back to like sort of the modern history of the carnivore diet, some people would argue it started with a guy named Vilmar Stefansson, who was this Arctic explorer who spent you know, like a dozen years living among the Inuit and came back to, you know, New York and, you know, saying, hey, look, I lived, you know, for all these years without meat, without any plants and just eating meat. And they all thought he was crazy. No, you couldn't have done that. Right. And so they put him in an experiment for a year. Him and his buddy Carsten Anderson were the two subjects done at Bellevue Hospital back in 1928. And, you know, they did a year of no part. Now, he had some organ meats during that time, but what he states, you know, in a nice interview from 1957 was, look, it's a complete diet with just meat and fat. Our organs, we didn't really eat. They threw them to the dogs. What I've seen, and this is kind of interesting because when I discovered this crazy group of people doing this all meat diet, which I thought they were nuts, right? Of course, like everybody else does. None of them really consuming many organ meats. And when some people talk about it, they said, you know, that's not necessary. And the people that often do that, they often do it for a little period of time, then they quit the diet anyway and they leave. And that's what you see. The big organ meat proponents basically have done the same thing. They've done their organ meats, said how great it was, and then they quit the diet, you know. And the people that have sustained this diet for, you know, years and decades, and there are many people that have, generally tend to either eat them sparingly or never at all. I think, you know, obviously, yes, they're high in nutrients and things like that. So is a multivitamin, quite honestly. But, you know, and maybe during the beginning, there might be some advantage to sort of, you know, sort of macrodosing micronutrients in a way. But over a period of time, that seems to fade. You know, I'm not saying that you don't need them. You shouldn't eat them because clearly some people enjoy them. I don't particularly. But I collected data on 12,000 people on this diet asking organ meat, no organ meat, and there was really no difference in the outcomes. Harvard University, when they did that study in 2021, I specifically told them and asked them to ask that question, and they found the same thing, no difference in outcomes. And so, you know, my position on that is pretty neutral. I think if you like them, eat them. If you don't like them, no big deal. You can do fine without them.
Tell us more about the survey of all these people. I mean, what did you find?
Oh, when I did it? Okay. So we had 12,000 people. We asked them, obviously, you know, several outcomes about just, you know, different, we didn't have a lot of money. It wasn't a study that we could pay for. So it was all based on what information we could gather quite cheaply. And it was a lot of symptomatic stuff. How's your mental health, digestive health, arthritis, on and on. And that largely, for the most part, was very, very positive across the board. We saw that, it's like 70% were able to either completely discontinue all medication for various, but across the board for diseases. And almost the other 20% were able to dramatically decrease medications. Most people lost significant weight if they're overweight. We found that, and we scaled it by, you know, what percentage carnivore were you? Because some people were 90% plus, some were 80% plus, some were 70% plus. This gets to your original question. And the people in the 70% group definitely got better, and the effect was slightly better at 80%, and even a smaller bit better at 90%. So there is like a, you know, there is like a, you know, you know, it kind of, you know, it kind of asymptotically gets better as you get more and more strict. And what we found was about 3 months seemed to be the inflection point for most people seeing improvement. So that's why I tell people, do it for 90 days. If it works, if it's going to work, it's probably going to work by then. And if you don't get any benefit from it, then hey, you know, go try something else. But that was the data that we had, and that, you know, that was not too dissimilar to what Harvard found when they surveyed their 2,000 people.
Was there any big differences between what you and Harvard found?
No, not really. I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, Harvard analyzed lab data, which we didn't have, you know, really a lot of consistent access to. And they didn't for every patient, but the ones they did, they found generally a proven. They saw a trend towards higher LDL cholesterol, which, you know, which is not unexpected, but decrease in triglycerides, decrease in hemoglobin A1C. You know, the diabetic cohort did extremely well in that Harvard study, because it's like 92% of the type 2 diabetics were able to come off insulin completely. They dumped all their SGLT2 inhibitors, the GLP-1 receptor agonists. They got off 100% of those. Even 84% of them were able to ditch metformin, which is, you know, just a pretty, you know, standard oral drug for, as you know, for diabetes.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen rapid reduction in medications, blood pressure medications, diabetes medications are typically the first to go, I find. And another really big one, acid reflux. It's pretty incredible. I have patients that like instantaneously don't have any more GERD and reflux symptoms. People listening, they're like, okay, chicken and pork are meat. On a carnivore diet, can you eat any kind of meat? Why would beef be superior to something like pork or chicken?
Yes, you can eat any kind of meat you tolerate. And there are some people that do, like for me, I prefer beef to chicken. You know, if there's a buffet and there's beef on it and there's chicken on it, I'm going for the beef, you know, 100 times out of 100. I find that, you know, for me, it just seems to be more satisfying. And I think, you know, if we go back to our very primitive roots when we started hunting and we had early man, you know, even Homo sapien, initially we had very limited technology, spears, you know, and that's what we were hunting with. And you imagine trying to get adequate calories hunting birds with a spear, you're going to struggle to get all the nutrition you need. And, you know, of course, beef has a little bit of different nutrient profile anyway. And so I think beef is just a better, you know, or I would say red ruminant meat, just because lamb's quite good as well, is just a better source of nutrition overall. I mean, chicken's a good source of protein, and it obviously does have nutrition in there. But, you know, I find that most people, and there are exceptions, but most people tend to do better with some level, and usually quite a bit level of the red meat in there that seems to be better, which is the thing we demonize the most, right? Because I think it's obviously some of me thinks it's the conspiracy theorist in me thinks it's because they're trying to, you know, get us to eat all the processed food, which may or may not be true. I think it probably is. But at the same time, it just tastes better. Gosh, I mean, I think that's, I don't know what your opinion on that, but I find a steak way better 100%. Than a piece of chicken.
Beef over chicken and chicken over pork, unless it's bacon. I do like bacon. But you know, they demonize it because it has more fat. And I think that's a problem when I see women who come in and they're like, yeah, I'm eating chicken and fish and salads and they feel horrible. And I'm like, well, you're hungry. Eating a really low fat diet. Yeah. And which is a huge problem. Like our sex hormones are literally made from cholesterol, and cholesterol gets demonized and red meat gets demonized because it contains saturated fat. So let's go back to this comment you made about LDL cholesterol, how the LDL cholesterol goes up, because I am a gynecologist, and but I'm one of the only ketogenic metabolic health practitioners in my community. We're getting a few more, which is amazing. But there is a common theme that I will get a consult for a woman who will come in who says, yeah, I started the carnivore diet. I've been carnivore for a year and I just went to my primary care. They freaked out because my cholesterol is high. And so here I am in your office and I want some answers and reassurance. And typically I will send them for a CAC after I review their family history, and we'll look to see if there's any, you know, existing calcium there. We'll look at their other markers, you know, what's their CRP, what's their fasting insulin, what's their fasting glucose. I mean, other things that tell me the state of their metabolic health. But what has been your experience? What have you seen at Rivero as far as cholesterol and the carnivore diet? Because it's a common question.
Yeah, I mean, it you know, I would say that certainly it's not, it doesn't always go up, and sometimes it goes down. So there's a
mine went down.
A lot of people see it go down, and this is, I mean, actually good timing, because I spoke about this on Rogan's podcast. Is that I'm sure you know Dave Feldman and those guys, but anyway,
yeah,
he's been working on this for, you know, this sort of theory for the last, gosh, almost a decade now. And on the 8th of December, which is a few days from now, a week from today, they're going to be releasing their initial data to the world. And basically what they did was they took, 100 people with super high LDL cholesterol. You're talking 300, 400, 500 that have been on, you know, ketogenic and carnivore diets for 5 years or plus on average. And they're older people. They're all in their mid 50s to older. And, you know, they did CCTAs, you know, CT angiography. And basically that cohort had basically no disease. I mean, very little to none, which is shocking in itself. They're going to follow them for, they're following for a year, and they'll be done collecting that data in February. And the thing, and again, we'll have more information, but yeah, that initial data set is quite amazing, that there may be, it gives credence to the thought that LDL cholesterol, or by extension ApoB, which LDL is a type of, is really a dependent variable. And so, yes, it's part of the atherosclerotic pathway, and you need it to have atherosclerosis. And so if you reduce it to zero, you're going to have very low heart disease. But is that practical? Is there negative effects to go into super low cholesterol? I think there probably is. But at the same time, it shows that there seems to be other factors that need to be in place. And so when you're checking for, glycemic control, inflammatory issues, hypertension, metabolic disease, that's probably what some of the things that drive that. In fact, the Danish Heart Registry study that came out last year showed that if you have a CAC of zero and you follow them up with high level CT angiography, the people, their LDL cholesterol was meaningless. It did not matter on what happened. If you have this baseline CAC score of zero, which indicates you don't seem to have those factors that contribute to cardiovascular disease, whatever they may be, diabetes, hypertension, metabolic disease. So that's interesting. So I think we're going to see maybe an acceptance that, you know, this is a, LDL is definitely causal to cardiovascular disease, but it requires the right environment, so to speak. And so one strategy would be to lower it as low as possible, but the other strategy might be let's fix all the metabolic issues, and you have an equally better, good outcome perhaps. That was one thing on that Danish study that they showed, that while LDL cholesterol had no bearing on what's called MACE, major adverse cardiovascular events, what did have an impact on that was smoking and diabetes, right? So so make sure you fix those things. I'm sure I know you're counseling all your patients stop smoking, and the ones that are pre-diabetic and diabetic, I'm sure when you see like your PCOS population that, you know, you fix their metabolic health and that stuff improves dramatically, I'm sure.
Yeah, 100%. I think that something that people are missing is the carnivore diet is a ketogenic diet. And so, call it what you want, but it's therapeutic ketosis. And I think that people don't really acknowledge the cellular signaling mechanisms of ketones. And I don't think we know everything, you know, but I hear people, you know, like Lane Norton that say, well, they just go on a keto diet and they reduce calories, and it's just the, you know, reduction of processed foods and reduction of calories why they're seeing these benefits. And I just don't think that's the case. I think that Dave Feldman is certainly onto something. When he presented this data at Low Carb Denver, I want to say, don't quote me, but these people had been on a ketogenic diet for like an average of like 4 years. It was, it was a significant amount of time. And so, you know, I think there's some question, you know, if you're in ketosis, does the LDL matter as much? Clearly this evidence is showing maybe it doesn't. They are going to be launching a separate part of the study. I'm going to be flying out to Vegas and helping him with that. That will have a control group of people who are not on a ketogenic diet that have LDL cholesterols of these, you know, significant proportions and comparing them. So we'll have something for comparison, which I think is super important. Interestingly, on a personal story, my husband and I went and got CAC scans a couple of years ago. Well, gosh, 2018, 5 years ago now. We had been ketogenic for like a year or two, initiated the carnivore diet because we saw this crazy man named Sean Baker on social media. I was like, really? Like all meat? So it was, December of 2018. We did like 30 days of straight carnivore. And that January, we went and got CAC scores. And mine was zero and his was not. And he was in his 30s at the time. It was like 137. Which is really high for somebody in their 30s. And nobody scans people this young. So we're like, oh my God, what do we do? So the cardiologists were like, you need a statin, you better take an aspirin, you better start exercising, which he was already. So we were like, what do? Do we double down on this lifestyle? His family history, his grandfather dropped dead of a heart attack in his early 50s. So there could be some genes, some genetic susceptibility that, you know, we actually didn't know at the time. So I think my husband lost sleep for like a whole year over this CAC scan, and we remained ketogenic, mostly carnivore. And we decided that we weren't going to repeat the test for 5 years because the data kind of shows that even if you have calcium, the rate of progression of the plaques or calcium is more helpful at predicting major events. So we went back and did a CAC scan, and this was actually right before Low Carb Denver, and his CAC came back at zero. So then we're like, oh my God, like, was the first test real or did he reverse his coronary calcium? So Dave Feldman was like, well, if this is real, everybody's going to ask if there's soft plaque because they did CCTAs in the cholesterol study. So I signed my husband up for a CCTA and he got a CCTA and his arteries are completely clean. So now we're having the original CAC images reviewed by a few different radiologists. I'm going outside the health system where it was done so we can try to get kind of some an unbiased second look. But if it's real, it's an interesting case report.
Yeah, and I remember you. I was there when you were telling. I brought you in front of Ivor Cummins to talk about that, and he was like, "Let's get Agassi to look at it and stuff like that." Yeah, I'm glad to hear that the CCTA was also, you know, clean, which is one of the things, because I had a zero coronary calcium scan. You know, I did that, you know, a couple of years after I started carnivore, and of course everybody said, well, you've got all this soft plaque, and I'm like, well, you know, I've got a VO2 max of like elite level, and it's unlikely. I'm completely asymptomatic. Yeah. I'm actually going to repeat my CAC score this coming year, so it'll be like a 6 year interval, and so we'll see, and hopefully still zero, I'm hoping so. Yeah, but that's awesome. That really is, and I think that is one of the things. And even the American Heart Association recognizes the utility of a CAC score to de-risk population. So if you've got somebody with a questionable family history and maybe high cholesterol and you run a CAC score on them and it's zero, that's considered at least contributing to the potential to de-risk somebody. So maybe they don't need statin therapy. So so that's great. That's great for your husband too.
And, Agassin, who developed the CAC, says that you can't reverse it. And many cardiologists say you don't want to reverse it because the calcium, you know, stabilizes these plaques. And, but my own mother has horrible coronary arteries. Her CAC is like 1800 or something like this. And, but she initiated a ketogenic diet, started doing exercise, saw a few different cardiology people. And then on a repeat subsequent scan, her number actually went down too. So it's actually just, there's a lot of questions in my mind as to what's really happening. And like I said, I think that there's so much we don't know about therapeutic ketosis and what the ketones actually do. Yes, they're energy, but I think that they do so much. I mean, we know they do more. They're HDAC inhibitors. They're anti-inflammatory. They inhibit the NLRP and 3 inflammasome, which I think is why people see these amazing benefits on low carb and ketogenic and carnivore diets.
Yeah, let me just, you know, because you hear that what's all about calorie reduction type of thing. But I get, you know, in many cases, the opposite, where people actually put on weight, put on muscle. I've dealt with a number of anorexics that were like, you know, gosh, women that are like 70 pounds and they go carnivore. And not only do they treat their eating disorder and, you know, no longer have that horrible, horrible, you know, highly fatal disease of anorexia, but they normalize their weight and they get back up to, you know, 110, 120 where they should be, and they've gained weight and yet they're healthier. And so how does that, you know, that calorie reduction doesn't, I've seen like really thin rheumatoid arthritic patients, the same thing where they actually put on weight, they put on muscle. Obviously they're consuming more calories than they were before and yet they still get healthy. So it's not all about weight loss. Well, I mean, both of us would agree that if you're obese, you should lose weight. I mean, that's clearly helpful, but there's more going on, absolutely. And you know, there's a ton of research on ketosis, and it shows just, I mean, there's literally thousands of studies out there now. So there is something going on with that for sure.
No, I've seen it. I'll get, it's usually like my menopausal patients who, they feel better, but they are so obsessed with the number on the scale. And I have to remind them that like cream, you know, butter, eggs, these things are calorically dense. So you can still overeat on a low carb ketogenic carnivore diet. And there still can be benefits beyond the caloric restriction. I'm totally with you on that. You had mentioned your son had a birthday. You ate some pumpkin pie. Does your family, I have three kids and a husband. Does your family eat the same diet as you?
No, they don't. I mean, they eat a lot of meat. I mean, for sure. I mean, that's prioritized. I mean, my son's like, you know, finish your steak and then you can eat the other stuff. Right. So, I mean, they eat basically like our dinner around our house. I'm cooking steaks and we're cutting up some like cheeses. And there's usually like some fruit on there, like an apple or something like that. And that generally tends to be the family's diet. My son will eat, you know, every once in a while he'll eat some stuff that, you know, is not ideal, quite honestly. But I mean, generally they're getting a lot of protein for sure. I mean, my eldest daughter is a tremendous athlete and she's like, I'm like, sweetie, get, you know, protein, get your gram per pound every day. And so they're getting, I mean, they consume dairy, they consume meat, they consume fish, they rarely consume vegetables because they don't like it. I mean, I don't force them. There's a couple that eat a little bit. But yeah, they're pretty much on, you know, I think generally a whole food diet, but very, very protein and meat focused for sure.
Same. My kids will do, I have one kid that'll do cauliflower, another one that thinks it's like the devil.
I'm with your second kid. even when they want to do keto and all the cauliflower rice, I was, this is disgusting. Why would anybody eat this? Just give me rice if I'm going to do that.
Yeah. But they'll have one kid that really likes, you know, blueberries or strawberries. And I mean, they're really active. They don't have any health conditions. They seem to do fine with it, but same, they eat whatever protein we're eating. So whether it's last night we had sirloin steaks and, and same thing, we're like, eat your protein first. If you eat your meat, you know, you can have the other things. And, we're not dictators, you know, they are going to leave our house one day and have to make these decisions in the big old scary real world. And we're more about just teaching them how the food makes us feel and not vilifying that like this is bad and this is evil and this is good. I want them to learn and just really be more empowered with that knowledge, because, you know, the world is obviously not teaching them.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as my kids were old enough to read, when they were like 4 or 5 years old, you know, they would ask me, we'd go to the grocery store and I'd say, hey, let's turn a label on and see what's in there. Okay. And then I would talk about what these foods may make, how they feel and what it can do to your body and why it's important to have this type of food. And I think, unfortunately, most kids being raised now, and you probably see a lot of these, well, I don't know, not in your practice, but you see these kids where they just, I mean, the entire calculus to what you're going to feed the kid is, what does it cost and how much, what does it taste like, you know, because will they eat it? Is it yummy? And what does it cost? And a lot of times that ends up being just as, once again, the ultra processed food companies. I mean, I had a gal who, I don't want to say gal, she was retiring, she was in her 60s, but she had worked as a chemist for one of these big giant food corporations. And she said her job literally was to design food that was as addictive as possible. And she felt so bad about it. She wanted to come work for our company. She's like, I just can no longer live with myself that I, you know, live with the fact that I've basically done this to harm literally millions of people. And it's real important.
We understand that. We have a few large food manufacturers. Conagra is here in Omaha. And I always ask my patients what they do for a living. And I had a patient a number of years ago who said she is a food scientist. And I said, well, what do you actually do? And her entire job was to create the peanut butter flavoring for the cookies. It was her entire job, peanut butter flavoring for cookies. And then I had another gal who makes the works for the Birds Eye division of Conagra and makes the sauces for the vegetables. So her job as a food chemist was to make you want to eat the broccoli with cheese sauce or whatever concoction they, put in there. These people did not feel guilty. This
Well,
was
but I mean,
early in my career before
yeah,
I
but
was
you,
food gen
I mean,
expert.
if you know that they're actually trying to addict you to these foods, I mean, and they're doing a good job and they're making a lot of money on it. I mean, good for them from the business side, but it's making our job more difficult, and it's what's creating business for physicians. I mean, it's really a good model when you're talking about from a financial side, because the healthcare system benefits from all the sick people and they make a profit off of that, and the food company profits from selling the food. So it's, like I said, it's not a conspiracy theory to see that businesses want to make a lot of money. And this is the sad thing is people are getting sick because of it.
Yeah, what do they say? If you want to make money and make people happy, sell ice cream. And it's like, okay, I want to hear what Rivero Health is doing, so that people are in touch and in tune with that. Are you guys doing studies? Are you just taking care of patients? What's
Yeah,
happening at
well, so
Rivero?
we will be publishing studies. I mean, we're gonna audit our practice and publish, the findings, whatever they are. Hopefully they'll show what I think they're gonna show. So we everybody that comes in will be collecting all their data and being able to use. And everybody knows they come in that you may be part of a basically, a presentation of our data. I mean, right now we're starting out with basically sort of the cardiometabolic type issues, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, obesity, and as also with inflammatory and autoimmune conditions. And so we have all these clinical protocols that have been developed by a team of physicians to take care of those issues. We're going to be, like I said, we just literally are about to launch. I mean, we've got thousands of people on the waiting list, but we haven't started seeing our first patients yet. That will happen either mid part of December in a few weeks or first of the year. So we'll have to see how it goes. Obviously, we'll do it with a small cohort of patients, make sure everything's working like we want it to, and then expand it out because we're licensed in all 50 states. We've got physicians ready to go. And so, hopefully it will be a resource for people that, either, want to, step out of the traditional routine of, go to the doctor, get a diagnosis, get a pill, which is, we've gone from healthcare to disease management to what I call disease maintenance, because you just kind of maintain people perpetually in the state of disease and kind of deal with their symptoms. And so, yeah, it'll have a heavy emphasis on obviously nutrition. Not some people will go carnivore, but not all of them. I mean, probably most people probably won't, quite honestly. But we will be definitely probably, geared towards low carb. We'll be looking very closely at and using AI to determine if we can start finding patterns within XYZ disease process versus XYZ demographic information and see if there's ways to figure this stuff out, because it's a very complicated problem, as you might imagine. And then, of course, obviously, as things progress over time, like we mentioned, maybe you use carnivore to fix your gut, get rid of the inflammation, whatever, whatever, and then you can reintroduce. And so we'll have kind of, it'll start out with kind of a, an introduction elimination, kind of a transition phase, eliminate to the degree you need to, and then perhaps reintroduce depending upon the desire of the patient and what we can, safely do. So that's, and then I, we
Awesome.
don't, I, obviously, and you and I both are in the same way. The exercise part is so important. We haven't built that in yet, but that probably be something that I'm going to sort of push for at some point to somehow either partner with somebody. Or get, because I think, once you get people where they're not sick anymore, where they don't feel miserable, now you can say, well, where do you go from there? And in my view, it's like, hey, let's create some robust, vigorous, people with a lot of vitality. And I think that's the other part of the equation. As you know, sleep, exercise, and nutrition are probably the pillars, maybe stress reduction, probably the biggest pillars of overall health.
Yes, thank you. I wrote a book back here called Hard to Kill about the five pillars,
Okay,
which
well,
are
I missed one.
nutrition, exercise, sleep, stress, and environment. So thank you
Environment.
for the
Okay.
plug.
Okay.
But
So I guess so
well,
good.
but
Yeah.
I was about to ask you, I mean, I came into this diet in 2015, 2016 because I had prediabetes and hypothyroidism, and I was a fat, overweight, tired doctor mom. As soon as I started eating right, it was like the lights came on. I did. I started feeling more energized, more vitality. And now I'm in the gym and I'm lifting weights and now I'm sleeping. And now I just installed this room with like a sauna and an ice bath. And because it's like Super Mario Brothers, like once you achieve level 26, like you want to know what 27 feels like. Yeah. And you know, the aging process is inevitable, but I'm just here to kick ass for as long as I can. But so tell people you eat a carnivore diet, but like, what else do you do, Sean, to like optimize your health?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I eat, you know, so obviously a carnivore diet. I work out. I'm an athlete for gosh. I've been lifting weights for 45 years. I mean, I you know, and so I'll be 57 in, you know, a few weeks. And I, you know, one of the things that, you know, and some people will disagree with this, but one of the things I've always heard, wait till you turn 30, wait till you turn 40, you got to slow down. You can't do that stuff. And I'm in the opposite camp. I think that you should maintain as high a level of capacity as possible for as long as possible. You know, you look at like, you know, and Ted Naiman sort of used this analogy I thought was great. So if I'm trying to get on camera here. So if you've got a life, you know, capacity, and this is laying in bed and this is doing backflips, right? As you're a kid, as you get older and older, those that gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. And then so probably, you know, when you're 50, you know, you can't even run sprint. You know, it's embarrassing that after 30, something like not even 5% of the population runs a sprint again. And so you get to this point where you're just smaller and smaller. Pretty soon it's like, all I can do is walk around my house. All I can do is lay in bed and then I'm dead. And so it's like maintaining that high level of functional capacity, pushing yourself. And you got to do it so you don't get hurt, obviously, but pushing yourself hard routinely and regularly is going to maintain that capacity as long as possible. And I use the analogy, you need to put hard to kill, which I think is a great, you know, a great analogy, but hard to die, I guess, is the other thing. But, you know, if you think about what makes me hard to kill, I can fight off a bear, I can run real fast, whatever. But I think the same things that would make us vulnerable to being chased down and eaten by the bear are the same thing that makes us vulnerable to chronic disease. Because, you know, I always maintain, if you line up 100 people and put them on the starting line and say, run 100 meters as fast as you can, there's going to be a point where the ones that can do it fast are going to live longer, right? Just from disease standards, because you think,
I mean, but it's not even sprinting. It's like, we know that grip strength is a predictor of all cause mortality, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
well, grip, you know, and a lot of people say, well, I'll just train my grip and live longer. That's not true. Basically it's a proxy marker.
It's a proxy for
overall body strength. Right. So, I mean, it's like, yeah. So if you're going to be stronger, you're probably going to live longer. If you're going to be stronger, you're probably less likely to get dementia and cardiovascular disease and diabetes and, you know, cancer, quite honestly. And so, it's so important. Obviously I do strength training. I do hypertrophy work. I do sprinting. I do jumping. I do all the things. I'm working more on mobility because, you know, I'm doing more jiu-jitsu now. And so that requires a little bit more, sort of different, you know, mobility requirements. So that's important. I do some of these sort of, you know, hormetic type things. I've got a sauna, which I use periodically. I've done the cold therapy. I don't have a cold thing right now, but it's pretty damn cold where I'm at anyway. So I walk around outside and get exposed to some of that. I try to get good sleep. I mean, it doesn't always happen. It depends how busy I am and what's going on. But, those simple basic things, I mean, I guess if you just focus, like you said, on those five pillar things and maximize those things, that's going to get you 99% of the way there. And then the other things, you know, the various supplements and supplemental activities, red light therapies, and all those types of things are probably a minor contribution. But you're not going to take a supplement and stand in front of a red light and have a crappy diet and never sleep and exercise to expect to get any kind of result. It's just like a waste of time. So you got to do the basics. And I'm big about just keep it simple, consistently with the basics. And to me, it makes the most sense to me. It probably has the most, you know, support behind it for sure. I mean, there's a ton of research that shows that nutrition affects health, you know, exercise affects health, sleep affects health. I mean, I think no one would disagree with that. Now they would disagree about what type of nutrition. Obviously we've got the people that think we should all be eating beans and celery all day long. And that's the key to health. But I don't know if that debate will ever go away, but I disagree with that proposition.
Right. Well, you know what hill I'm dying on, so my grave will be next.
Well, you know, as I said, even if I die early, I'll die happier, you know, because I got some steak in my belly.
That's right. That's right. Well, Sean, this has been so incredible. I just love talking to you, and I love the work that you're doing, and I'm super excited to see, what you're going to do over there at Rivero and how many people you're going to help. Tell people how they can find you, find your book.
Oh yeah, so obviously Rivero.com is where you can go to, if you want to, if you're interested in what we have to offer. I'm on social media, which some people like it, some people don't. I'm kind of a, anyway. So Instagram, Sean,
To some people, you're famous, and to some people, you're infamous.
Infamous, right? Yeah. So it's kind of funny because I'll get recognized occasionally. I'm sure you do once in a while. And like I'm in an airport or something like that. It's always been positive so far. So, I mean, I'm sure the haters are out there, but they don't want to, maybe because I'm 6'5" and 250.
You're huge. What are they going to say to you?
So maybe that protects me a little bit. But yeah, so Sean, Shawn Baker, Baker, 1967 on Instagram. I'm on Twitter, or sorry, X now, S Baker MD, and I'm on YouTube, Sean Baker MD. And so that's where I'm doing whatever, talking about silly stuff.
Awesome. Well, this has been great. You guys share this episode, like it, comment, send it to your cousin, send it to all of your vegan friends. We're not here to make fun of them. We just, Sean and I both deeply as physicians care that people are getting healthier because we're on the worst trajectory we've ever seen in humankind. So, if you guys like this episode, please share it with the world. We appreciate you.
Thanks for having me, Jimmy.
Did you guys love that last episode of the Fit and Fabulous podcast? Well, of course you did. And I want to keep bringing you the most amazing content from the most incredible people. And you can help me by subscribing to the Dr. Fit and Fabulous channel. You guys know where the button is. Just click it. It's the doctor's orders.